This season, Toyota Racing is looking for jugglers.
Aha!
Not the ones who toss balls or rings. Fans that can juggle the rigors of a 10-month-long season across many different racing circuits.
Well, what if I added knives?
What if you added GR Cup, Formula Drift, and off-road racing? If you can juggle it all, then we want you. Be part of the action at toyota.com/racing. Toyota, let's go places. Formula Drift is a registered trademark of Formula Drifts Holdings, LLC.
It was a season that saw seeds planted by a legend bloom on the biggest stage possible.
I still think of 2004 as part of the healing from 2001.
This has got to be the greatest day of my life.
A season that brought out the best.
We're right in the middle of this championship, so we'll just see what happens at Homestead.
And the worst.
And now they're tackling one another and a fight is on in the pit area.
While crowning a champion in the most suspenseful way.
We dodged a huge, huge, devastating proposition that would have taken us out of this championship.
A racing season that was one of the most impactful in the sport's history.
There's so much going on behind the scenes in 04, but the headlines that made the sport continue, I think will be 25 years from now when we're celebrating the 100th, somebody will look at a yardstick of our history and 2004 is going to be on there.
Motor Racing Network welcomes you to NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. Hello, everybody. I'm Mike Bagley. Welcome back to NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. When we were last together, in Episode 2, we dissected races 2 through 8 of the 2004 season. We also discussed NASCAR's last visit to Rockingham, the rise of Casey Kane, and NASCAR Hall of Famer Rusty Wallace ending his winless streak at Martinsville. In this episode, we'll cover races 9 through 13 of the 2004 season, a stretch that included a controversial ending at Talladega, Jeff Gordon separating himself as a season contender, and a winless streak of one of NASCAR's most respected drivers finally coming to an end. So, with Rusty Wallace still basking in the glow of a Martinsville win, the NASCAR Cup Series headed south to Alabama, to the Talladega Super Speedway. And at that time, one driver was dominant at this style of racing. And that driver was Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. was coming off an impressive speed weeks at Daytona, but as far as Talladega was concerned, he won and he finished second in 2003. Dale Jr. was the man at plate tracks. Fans were in awe, and so was MRN's Dave Moody.
Junior Nation had a very high bar of expectation for Super Speedway races that year. Junior and his team, his whole organization, were far and away the dominant organization on the big tracks. And whenever they had a car in contention to win at Daytona or Talladega, they pretty much did. So based on the Earnhardt name and the Earnhardt legend at Talladega, and based on the fact that he was running up front and very competitive, a lot of folks in that jam-packed grandstand just assumed that Junior was going to go to victory lane and they were going to have a big old party.
Now, throughout his career, Junior had earned the respect of numerous peers, and it was expected that he would find his way to the front at Talladega. The result spoke for itself. Tony Urie Jr., who was Dale's car chief at the time in 04, recalls a bet he made with the flagman that eventually led to a meeting in the NASCAR hauler.
I got called to the NASCAR truck on this one, but it was like the flagman. I remember him coming by. He come by me about, I think it was Sunday morning. He comes by and he's doing his little check, and he's like, "So, how you going to do today?" And I'm like, "Well, I feel like I'll do pretty good." And I remember the guy going, "So, how are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'll do all right." I said, "I think he'll do good." And he goes, "What lap do you think he'll be leading on?" And I said, "Well, probably 7. Like that, and he starts laughing, and he goes, "Well, I think about 2. And I said, "2? I said, "That's pretty aggressive. I don't know if he'll make it in 2. I said, "7? Possibility, but I said, "I don't know about no 2. So, and we just laughed and went on. And the race fired off, and I remember they threw the green, and as soon as they threw the green, he went to the top. And he got in the top lane, and there were some guys pushing him. And when he come by the first lap, he was running 11th or 12th. And I was like, "We picked up 12 spots in one lap." And I'm sitting there and listening, and the crowd went nuts. I mean, you could just hear them like roaring, and then I'm watching the TV, and he is passing everybody on the outside. And when he got to turn 4, he took the lead. And this is lap 2. And I was just blown away. I was like, "How did he just do that?" You know? So he takes the lead. He comes through the travel, and I just started laughing. And I was like, well, hey, bud. I said, do me a favor. I said, when you come by the flag stand the next lap, I said, give the flagman the thumbs up because he won the bet. And so if you go back and look, he's coming through the travel, and he's got his thumb sticking out the window net to the flagman. And as soon as he did it, like they, you know, they're scanning everybody, and they're like, I'd like to see the flagman and the crew chief of the 8 car in the trailer after the race. Because they honestly thought we had done something, you know. And it was like, no, we've just, you know, just BSing in the garage, and it just so happened. But I'd have never dreamed in a million years that he took it in 2 laps. But, you know, it was just, that was a testament of just how strong the cars were and how good he was at drafting. I mean, I think Dale Jr. was a better drafter than his dad.
In his career, Dale Earnhardt Jr. would earn 6 victories at Talladega Super Speedway. But in the spring of 04, a different driver was ready to dethrone Jr. from his super speedway throne.
The Aarons 499 about to get the green flag. It is in the air and they are underway. Now to the inside goes Ricky Rudd, outside Michael Waltrip. They'll race door to door. They'll stay that way as they get over to turn number 2. Right now, everybody's a bundle of nerves as they go to 1.
Almost a pedestrian pace as they hit the banking in turn number 1 for the first time. It'll take nearly a full lap for these machines to come up to full song, but they remain side by side and inches apart. Ricky Rudd low, Michael Waltrip up high.
As the Aarons 499 unfolded and the laps wound down, Jimmy Johnson, Jeff Gordon, and Tony Stewart were pacing the pack. But with 28 to go, a familiar face would battle his way to the front.
Nobody sitting down at Talladega. Dale Earnhardt Jr. back out front. Michael Waltrip goes second, but from third on back, they're 2 and 3 wide. As the crowd goes crazy here at Talladega, Jr. out front of Michael Waltrip.
With 5 laps to go, Jeff Gordon and Dale Earnhardt Jr. had battled back and forth up until that point. Then something unexpected happened.
Jeff Gordon down low. Gordon has drafting help from Kevin Harvick and Robbie Gordon. Earnhardt has drafting help from Jimmy Johnson. Gordon goes to the lead. Now they're side by side for second.
And Jeff Gordon is out front, but Dale Earnhardt Jr. No, travel now. Looks like Brian Vickers goes around. Ricky Rudd may have gotten into him. The spinning car of Brian Vickers sliding down on the inside of the apron.
Caution flag is displayed at lap 183 as Earnhardt Jr. leads him back down to the start-finish line. Again, the problem occurring between turns 3 and 4.
When the caution flag came out, NASCAR froze the field and deemed Gordon the leader at the time of the caution. The next question at hand was whether or not NASCAR safety crew had enough time to clear the track before the race ran out of laps.
Now, the chief starter here has the white flag in one hand, getting ready to display it. The caution flag is still displayed, so I think that's pretty indicative of the fact that this is going to end under the caution flag here this afternoon, and Jeff Gordon will get the win, his first of the 2004 season. Tough. A lot of folks are not going to be very happy with the way this thing turned out, but that's just the way it turned out.
What was the difference between you and Gordon there at the end, Dale?
Wasn't no difference. I thought I was ahead of him before the caution came out, but apparently NASCAR has a different opinion, but we'll just see what they show us and go with that.
Jeff, you seem about as excited as you've ever been in victory lane. Congratulations.
Well, anybody needs to be excited about getting to victory lane, especially, beating those DEI cars is so difficult to do, and we did everything we could. I didn't know, whether I was ahead of them or not there at the end, but I knew I was ahead of them going into 3, and I know it's going to be controversial, but I don't care.
Chaos ensued. Fans were outraged with NASCAR's decision to finish the final laps under caution, and then proceeded to pelt beer cans and whatever they could muster onto the racetrack. A scene MRN's Dave Moody recalls as one he hopes never happens again.
I had never seen anything like it, and quite honestly, I hope I never do again. I think, NASCAR Nation kind of showed its worst side that day. I understand that they were upset. I understand that their guy didn't win. A lot of that unhappiness came from the fact that the rules had changed since the previous year, and a lot of people just didn't understand the rule change and expected that they were going to re-rack and give everybody a chance to race one more lap for the checkered flag. And when that didn't happen, the combination of their guy not winning, not understanding the rules, Jeff Gordon inheriting the win, who at that time was not the most popular guy on the planet due to the fact that he'd won far too many races for some people's taste, it just kind of all compounded and turned into a very ugly reaction by our fan base that, again, I hope we never see the likes of again.
What transpired at the end of that race was a low point for the sport, and many new changes needed to be made to ensure something like that never happened again. This wasn't the first occasion a late race caution led to an anticlimactic ending.
Having the Daytona 500 end under the caution flag was kind of like ordering Dolly Parton and having Phyllis Diller delivered in the mail. That ain't what I bought my ticket to see. As happy as we all were when Dale Earnhardt won the Daytona 500, the fact that he chugged around under caution behind the damn pace car for the final two laps, that's not the way we wanted to see Dale Earnhardt win the Daytona 500. So yeah, as far as I'm concerned, whatever we have to go through, however many green-white checkers we have to sweat out, you know, when it's already too late in the afternoon, I'm more than happy to do that.
Because of what transpired that spring in Talladega, later that summer, NASCAR would implement a new overtime rule. That rule would allow for additional laps where a green, white, checkered flag finish would transpire when cautions prevented the race from finishing under the green flag. It may have made the crew chiefs and drivers' jobs a little more difficult when it came to strategy, but Greg Biffle and Jeff Burton both believe this was the right thing to do for the fans.
I think that the fans deserve to see the race finish under green. I think there's a limit to that as well. I like the fact that they, you know, they only did it a couple times. I think it was different when they first implemented it. I don't remember. But I like it. I really like that. You don't like it when you're leading and it's two to go and the caution comes out. But it's for the sport, for the better of the sport, I like it. I feel like it helps, and I did have some experience doing that, you know, in the truck series prior to them implementing it.
I do remember that moment where it got ugly, and certainly we don't want fans voting with their beer cans. But in retrospect, I think it's pretty simple to think. We talk about all the changes. It's pretty simple to understand why racing back to the caution wasn't a good idea, and how giving fans an opportunity to see a green-white checkered, how that is a good idea. So we can talk about all the changes not being good, but some of them were certainly good.
The next week couldn't come soon enough, and it included a trip to the West Coast and a visit to the Auto Club Speedway in California. When qualifying wrapped up, again, Casey Kane grabbed another pole and continued to impress during his rookie campaign. The Auto Club 500 would display two competitors trading the lead throughout the duration of the event.
If Jeff Gordon grabs the lead, it would be the third time this afternoon that he has led, the first time since lap 66. Here they come to the stripe by a nose. Jeff Gordon is your leader here at the California Speedway. But trust me, the battle's not over. They're back in turn one.
Indeed they are, and they're side by side with a lap car in the mix for good measure, and they're going to split the lap car. Brian Vickers. Kane has to go way high. Jeff Gordon to the bottom. They're side by side and three wide for the lead.
Kane has yet to close the deals and slingshots off of turn two. What now he does. So Casey Kane takes back the lead. Jeff Gordon slots back into his second spot, and those two have broken far away from the rest of the field.
Great racing going on for the top spot, and again, they're all thinking fuel mileage and how this thing's going to play out. Not slowing them down at all. Here goes Gordon again, taking a move to the inside lane, pulling even with Casey Kane as they come back to the start-finish line. Gordon again by inches as they cross the stripe, and Casey Kane still there working the outside line in turn one.
Sure doesn't look like a couple of guys worried about fuel mileage. They're going at it hammer and tongs for the lead right now. Casey Kane goes way high, gets up in the loose stuff. That may be enough for Gordon. He's got room downstairs, and he's got the lead off two.
That would be the last time the 24 would face a challenge in his rearview mirror.
The bright California sun will shine on a native son, as Joe said at the opening of the broadcast. Career win number 66, California win number 3 for Jeff Gordon and the DuPont team. He takes the win in the Auto Club's 500.
That win was Gordon's second of the season and the 19th time in his career that he had won back-to-back races. So 10 races were not complete in 2004, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. still hung on to the top spot in the championship standings by 25 points over Jimmy Johnson. This was something that the 8 team held a high emphasis on, as Tony Urie Jr. believes the first 10 races of a season meant everything.
Any point system you go into, your first 10 races, it makes the rest of your life easy. So, like, if you look at where the guys are after race 10, normally, not many spots change other than 8th through 12th, something like that. Like, pretty much, if your first 10 races, if you don't wreck, you don't have a problem, you finish in the top 6 or 7, like, you've locked yourself into where you're sitting in a pretty good spot. So if you do have an accident at Pocono or you have a motor blow up at Michigan, like, you got a cushion. Because in July, things don't change as quick. Like, when you're at Daytona and you blow a motor, you're sitting there, let's just say you go to second race and you were fourth in the points and you mess up, well, you could go to 24th. You know, big changes happen, but in the summertime they don't. So we always said, first 10 races, let's get them under our belt.
Not only was Junior in a good spot on the championship standings, he was returning to one of his favorite tracks in Richmond. Coming out of the first practice, Dale was fourth quickest, and that's exactly where he would qualify for that Sunday's Chevy American Revolution 400. The man he would end up chasing was Brian Vickers, who had earned his first career pole by setting a new track record. Now, Vickers would fade early in the race, though, and it was a constant throughout this time of the season. Jimmy Johnson and Dale Earnhardt Jr., the two top drivers in the points, would exchange the lead, but Junior would cruise to the win after the last caution.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. for the final time, coming back into turn number two, sliding down to the inside lane of the racetrack. Kevin Harvick gets back around him, not pushing the issue, as Dale Earnhardt Jr. comes off the end of the back straightaway looking for the checkered flag.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. works his way off turn number four. The checkered flag is waving as he brings it home here at Richmond tonight and wins.
The last pitted at lap 294. You elected to stay out at 345, and you hang on for the win. Talk about the victory tonight, Dale.
Yeah, it was a great race car. Just had a great long run set up on it. The Urys really worked on the car this weekend and got it handling good. And thanks to my bud crew for doing what they did all weekend, getting the car driving good. I was real loose on new tires, so, you know, pitting really wasn't an option. It wasn't even an option for us. Staying out was the thing to do. And, man, what a great racetrack. You know, we won a few races here, and this is win number three for us. We're having a great season. Just want to thank them fans for giving me that ovation at the end of the race. That was awesome. It felt great.
That win was the 12th of Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s career, and for car chief Tony Urey Jr., it wasn't much of a shock that they had success at Richmond. Tony Urey Jr. felt that when it came to certain tracks, they had to bring a car good enough for Dale's driving.
There was racetracks like, let's say, Daytona, Atlanta, Richmond, Texas, places like that. It was like we had to make sure we brought a good enough car for him. Because it was certain races that he just stood up in the seat. Like, he wanted that race, or he wanted to be there. You know, if we went to a Darlington or a Rockingham, it was just like, oh, I got to go this weekend. You know, so it was like you had to kind of pump him up for it, but wasn't like Richmond or wasn't like Atlanta. Like, when we went to those two tracks, or he was going to be up in the seat. So you just knew you had to bring a good enough car for him to execute what we needed to do.
Next up on the schedule for NASCAR was a visit to the mile-and-a-half oval at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Up for grabs was the trophy of one of NASCAR's prized crown jewels in the Coca-Cola 600. The longest race of the year by mileage would be dominated by one name, Jimmy Johnson. Not only did he snag the pole, but Jimmy led 334 of the 400 laps, which was one of the most dominating performances of the season up to that point. Jimmy claimed his second checkered flag of 2004, and the team was starting to find its footing. When looking back on 04, Jimmy thinks that year the team really had to mature if they were going to take the next step as title contenders.
We just had a lot of growing and maturing to do. And, you know, I wasn't the only kind of youngster in our group. That entire team was just founded. We all started it together. So Chad Knaus in that role, I'm sure he might have had a year or two of a head start on me in the crew chiefing role. But, you know, at that caliber with those expectations and that pressure, that was new for him. And certainly all the guys on the team, we were all just a bunch of 20-something-year-old guys trying to figure it out.
And the final race we'll discuss on this week's episode took place in Dover, Delaware. Jeremy Mayfield snagged the pole and paced the pack for most of this race, but that wasn't the story of the MBNA America 400, though. The story would be about attrition. That day in Dover saw numerous cautions, but none was bigger than the caution on lap 347.
Mayfield forced to change lanes and go to the inside.
Casey Kane changes lanes. He goes to the high side. He goes to the lead off turn two. Now 10 cars directly ahead as Casey Kane takes the lead down the back straightaway. And there's a problem. Dave Blaney spins. Here's Jamie McMurray. They're going to wad him up now in turn three. There's going to be about 10 or 15 cars collected in turn three.
Going to be at least 10 involved in that over there as caution caution comes out on the racetrack immediately, the ninth one of the afternoon at lap 345. Let's go back to turn three.
Barney, something broke loose. Dave Blaney turned sideways right in front of half the field. We've got Ricky Rudd, Robbie Gordon, Ward Burton, Mark Martin, Jimmy Johnson, Greg Biffle, other cars that are collected down to the inside of the racetrack. We see Jeff Green down there as they really wadded up coming down the backstretch. All started when Dave Blaney got turned sideways.
That pileup was the biggest of the season that wasn't on a plate track, and this Dover race became a race of survival. Mark Martin saw an opportunity to do exactly that on old tires, a strategy call that led to the end of a 72-race winless streak for Mark.
Man, I forgot what it feels like. Golly. Hey, Matt, Arlene, we won! Pat Tryson is the man! I tell you, these guys are putting me in great race cars. I've been saying it all year. But everything went our way today. You know, the car got stronger and stronger all throughout the race, and then you know, it was just a gift there. When the oil was in the corner, I was running right on the bottom, and I just didn't get in it there when Casey did. And, you know, his misfortune was our fortune.
And just like that, the drought for Mark Martin was over. He wasn't the only driver to end a long winless streak that year. At Martinsville, Rusty Wallace had ended a 106-race winless skid. Mark and Rusty were good friends throughout their time in NASCAR, and still to this very day. Rusty was happy to see his friend's winless streak come to an end because there were numerous times he leaned on Mark throughout his career.
There's many times that I couldn't get my car handling right, and I'm running out of time in practice, and I'd run over to Mark Martin and say, hey, man, what do you got in that car? He'd give me the whole setup, and I'd run back, and I'd put it in my car. Whew, I said, that fixed it, and I'm pretty good now, you know. But, Mark and Diver, I'd give him anything, you know, and he'd do the same for me.
With a little over a third of the way through the 2004 NASCAR Cup Series season, we've witnessed controversy at Talladega, Jeff Gordon flexing muscles in back-to-back wins, Jimmy Johnson revving up for a series run at the title, and another NASCAR legend and future Hall of Famer make his return to victory lane. Next week on Episode 4, our journey through 2004 continues with a hot summer stretch where Hendrick Motorsports elevated themselves from the rest of the series.
Jeff Gordon started on the Bud pole tonight like he did last week at Infineon Raceway, and at the finish, he'll be up front like he did last week. Jeff Gordon wins the Pepsi 400. His teammate Jimmy Johnson comes in second.
I think as a driver, right, your goal and your skill set is how do you adapt to the conditions? How do you adapt to the length of the race? You know, how do you help the team set up the car based on what you're feeling? And so whatever race car I was in, that's what I felt like your job was, you know, to make sure that you read it and you excelled at it and you gave great feedback.
Until then, I'm Mike Bagley. For all of us here at the Motor Racing Network, thank you for joining us on NASCAR Live presents 2004 Chasing History.
Kyle Larson brings his Chevy in four tires, Sunoco Racing Fuel.
From fueling NASCAR champions on the track for over 20 years to innovating 94 octane, the highest octane on the market, performance is what Sunoco does. All Sunoco fuel at the pump meets the same top-tier standards as the fuel used in NASCAR.
Ryan's not here for Ryan Blaney. Four tires with Sunoco fuel.
From the track to your tank, you can trust Sunoco to help your vehicle perform at its peak.